Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this amazing live Tuesday night coming at you live from North Austin. Hope everybody is well. Sorry if anybody's getting any kind of weird issues, stuff like that in the feed tonight. Things have been going a little wonky. The Facebook stream will not start whatsoever. It's absolutely wild. The YouTube is up and going. The website is up and going. Could not get the Rumble going tonight. So sorry about those two folks. I'll be working on the Facebook stream as we go out and as we have our conversation. Before we get started, please do remember that tomorrow night in San Antonio is the Symposium of the Strange. Stop on by Magic Time Machine. We have the Klinga Brothers coming out to talk about Haunted Texas and Paranormal Texas. So some of their paranormal adventures, investigating in the Lone Star State, things like that. VIP tickets get a free book signed by the brothers, and everybody who attends gets a free poster. So yeah, stop on by, check it out. It's a bi-monthly series that Curious Events is helping out with. It's fantastic. It's put on by Ryan Edwards, our good friend and cryptozoologist there in the area, as well as our friend Rod Nichols of Bexar County Bigfoot. So hopefully we will see all of you guys there tomorrow night. Symposiumofthestrange.com is where you can find out more about that. Our guest in the first segment is the amazing Kathleen Ball. She is the creator of the documentary Brazilian Templar Mystery. She is in the midst of getting ready to release the second one. She just got back from a huge trip to Tomar in Portugal, researching the second one and more about the Knights Templar. In the second slot, we will be talking with Earl Gray as well as Mike Turber about the recent UFO panel and covering that, what it means to the community, what it means for the cause of disclosure. Welcome back for this first segment. Dr. Kathleen Ball, how have you been doing?
I've been really great.
You have been bebopping around the globe and visiting visiting all over the place. Let's get into a little bit of your recent trip. What locations did you get to visit? What things are you able to tell us about that you were able to uncover during that trip, Doctor?
Well, I want to kind of back up a little bit because I went to England, and I had a lecture series in England and London and another location. And then I actually went into France, and I've been collecting what they call Mason marks that have been all over these castles and, you know, Templar churches, castles, cathedrals, all over the place. And nobody can give me a really good explanation for what they are. So I talked to Scott Wolter about this, and I told him I thought that I believed it was some type of code possibly, and he agreed. So that's something that I'm going to be looking into more with him. And I've collected now about 300. But what I did was I just took off a little side trip and went to France, and I went to back to Dome and re-photographed more of the graffiti and the markings in where they held the Templars. And I found out they were only held from 1307 to 1310 there. And then they were transferred. Many of them were transferred to Chinon. So I went into Chinon as well, and I photographed everything in there. And then I went to Chartres Cathedral, photographed everything in there, and got another, you know, another collection, unbelievable, graffiti and iconography and Templar, you know, really, really good. Chartres Cathedral is a really good example of early Templar construction and phenomenal. So from there, I also went back into Amboise, France, which is where, Leonardo da Vinci had lived. And I found out that he actually lived less than 2 kilometers from a Templar church. And what was interesting about this particular church is that it was dedicated to, St. John the Baptist. So I was looking, I have been looking for the connection between Leonardo da Vinci and the Templars, and I think I finally found it. He was very interested. Everyone at that time were interested in what the Templars had brought back from Istanbul and from the Holy Land in terms of esoteric knowledge and wisdom.
Sure.
And many people were apparently practicing alchemy, and and it looks like Leonardo da Vinci may have been involved in that as well. But this, I think, was what precipitated a lot of the secrets that he put into his artwork in terms of the sacred geometrical forms and a lot of the secret coding that, you know, there's several people right now. What's that Grant? What's his name? Grant, Robert Edward Grant. Has okay. been really, really decoding a lot of Da Vinci stuff. So that was phenomenal. And then, of course, in, you know, during that trip, I also discovered numerous, crosses that are the exact same that are in the cave in Brazil that I discovered in 2015. So now I have a collection of crosses, and I went into Royston cave as well while I was in England. And again, I found same crosses that I discovered in the cave. So now I have a collection of places. You know, I've found this cross in Brazil, but it's also in France, it's in Spain, it's in Italy, it's in several locations in Portugal, it's in several locations in England and Scotland, and it's also in Istanbul. You know, I had uncovered that one that was in Istanbul as well. So, you know, so now I have... We've been able to push back the dates, especially as a result of this one church that I went to in Portugal, both trips in March, and then the one I recently got back from about 2.5 weeks ago. That church has that cross in repetition on the altar inside. And that church was built between 1040 and 1090. So, been able to push back the dates, possibly as early as, you know, 1090. I mean, it looks like any time between 1090 and 1315 or 1312, it looks like was when the Templars were over there in Brazil and dug out that cave.
Wow.
And left the graffiti on the interior of the cave. So that's huge. That is, it's a huge move forward with my research, and I'm really pleased about that.
Well, and a huge changing of the date as far as discovery over there, you know, and exploration over there.
You know, I had been, I've been chipping away at the state little by little. You know, when I interviewed the Kalunga a couple of years ago, the Kalunga are the people that they were on the slave ships, they had been captured in Africa and brought over to Brazil, the Portuguese and Spanish slave ships. And they jumped ship when they, you know, when they got close to shore, they jumped ship and swam, and they took off and they went into the area where I discovered the cave, and they stayed in these caves. So that pushed the dates back, you know, that, because they said when they arrived in these caves, these Templar caves were already there with the crosses on them and the graffiti inside. They were already in, they had been there for a long time.
Yeah.
So I had pushed that back. And then, you know, the Amazonian tribal natives talk of a time when the Templars apparently came, but they don't, you know, they don't live by dates, you know.
Yeah.
They live by a different kind of it's even difficult for us to wrap our heads around time frame. They think in terms of generations, you know, of people. And so all they could tell me was that they knew that the Templars had been through the Amazon and sometime, you know, several generations ago. So I had been chipping away little by little by little, but now I've got some really strong, solid evidence that we have some dates, and we can take the dates back now to, like I said, all the way back to 1090. From 1090 to sometime between there and 1312, they were definitely over there in Brazil.
That is absolutely incredible. And to know that you have once again begun pushing that date back. Now, when discovering this, when uncovering these things, Kathleen, how reticent are people to share them? Is it more finding documents from families, things like that? Because, I mean, I guess that's what a lot of people don't understand, is the familial connection across Europe with the Knights Templar, and the fact of, you know, it was kind of like giving your son to the seminary, so to speak, at the time. One of the main reasons Leonardo da Vinci would have had connection with them is because of his connection to the Medici family, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And we found evidence. I've been working with Hamilton White as well. We have Jacques Tister on this tour with me in October. And one of the things I did while I was in England, I spent 3 days with him, and he and I just, you know, did solid research for three solid days. We just knuckled down, and he opened up all the relics that he has. And we have evidence of the very first king in Portugal used the Medici. There's a specific number of balls of circle forms that he incorporated into his coat of arms that shows that he had a background or some relationship with the Medici family. Mm. Now, we do know now that the very first king of Portugal was not the count and his wife's son. That is another thing that is coming forth, you know, that's being uncovered now. He was actually the son of the count's Templar guard, his first man, Templar guard. So this son, his real son, his natural son, died at about 8 years old, and he had severe disabilities. He was born with both of his legs fused. So they had been training this young man to take over as king, and this was all done on the sly, secretive. So now what we have to do is find out who that first in arms, you know, that first guard, what his name was, as we haven't been able to figure that out yet. We haven't gotten down to that. But I suspect that when we do, there's going to show the connection to the Medici family.
Mm. Now, with this cave in Brazil, having pushed the date back, do you know how long their travels to Brazil were? Have you come across any documentation of that? How many times they traveled over there? When they stopped traveling over there? Did they stop traveling over there?
Nope. What we've been able to find is, on my trip to Portugal in March, I specifically went over there to consult with a fellow researcher, Mario Bello Pedro, who lived in Peniche. He was born and raised in this little coastal town called Peniche. It's a port. Anyway, come to find out that there's two commanderies in Peniche, ancient commanderies that were Templar commanderies. There were also convents that were used to teach the naval nautical skills to the incoming Templars. And we did some research and found out that every single one of the naval admirals lived in Peniche for 300 years. So we know that the Navy was based there. We think that this was utilized as a secret port, and it dates back to the 11th century.
Wow.
Yeah, this is phenomenal. I mean, this is huge. So what it appears, and then you have to keep in mind that when all of the, okay, when the Templars came back after they lost the fall of Acre in 1290, when everybody came back from the Holy Land, all of the monarchs in Europe were broke, all of them, except the King of Portugal. And the reason that he still had money is because the Templars were going back and forth to Brazil and Peru and bringing it back.
Mm.
His coffers were filled, but his coffers were filled with both gold and silver, silver from Peru and gold from Brazil.
Wow.
That explains why the Portuguese at that time, you know, and all the way up into the 14 and 1500s, I mean, they had, you know, all the money. I mean, they were rich. They had all the money, and they were building ships, and they had a navy fleet, and they were building all these amazing buildings and castles and all over. Portugal was flourishing when all the other countries were scrambling for money. I mean, we saw what King Philip the Fair did.
Yeah.
You know, he was so desperate faced out the Jews and had the Templars oppressed because he was so broke. He needed money.
Yeah.
He had similar issues in England, you know, with Edward III. I mean, Edward didn't do that. He didn't suppress the Templars. But, I mean, he was scrambling for money. All the monarchs were broke. That's why we didn't see any more crusades after that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they just dropped because they were broke. They couldn't afford it. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't afford to support another crusade over
there. And you know what, it's interesting because so much curiosity is there about where the Templars went. Did they leave to Portugal and find safe harbor in Portugal? Because, of course, the King of France levied charges against them of heresy, had them famously burned at the stake, captured, killed, all kinds of things, mainly because they would not help him round up the Jewish people of France to wipe their debt to him clean, or his debt to them clean. He was like, I can gladly get a whole bunch of money. Just help me round up these people and take all their belongings and I'll give it to you. And then we'll be square, right?
Well, yeah. And what happened, Chris, is that it was just the opposite. The Templars, what people don't realize, Templars, you know, I mean, this was phenomenal that when Freddie Silva published that book, A Templar Nation, that was
the first Templar Nation.
And then anybody really understood or got even like a little glimpse of what was really going on in Portugal. What was really going on in Portugal is Portugal was a template. That what the Templars' agenda is, what I've uncovered, they conquered the Moors and Islam and invited them to stay. And they had the Druids, they had the Druze, they had Christians, yep. They had Jews. They had every nationality and spiritual belief system, religious people with religious backgrounds, all living in Portugal. And what they did when King Philip went after the Jews in France, they rescued him and took him into Portugal. Same thing with Cathars.
Yeah.
I found evidence of Cathars all across Portugal.
Well,
Cathar crosses and evidence, historical evidence of the Cathars having, you know, masses of property, mass lands in Portugal that the Templars gave them.
But this work in Brazil, though, and especially the setting back of the date to 1090, Kathleen, changes so much of what we know of the Knights Templar and so much of the story, because I mean, so much of the story is the fact that they made their bones and got their money in the First Crusade, protecting pilgrims and basically being a bank that protected your cash on the way over there. Things like that. And for a small percentage, we'll give you a note. And when you get there, we'll give you your gold and all that kind of good. And that's how they made their money, aside from donation from very rich families.
They had a larger agenda that most people don't realize. And when I was in England, I did a lot of research on the records and found out that the Templars were embedded in the whole governmental system in England, also Germany, in France, and they own, I mean, Portugal was a Templar nation. There was no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And what it was, Portugal was actually a pilot program for what they wanted to see happen throughout the rest of Europe and eventually the rest of the rest of the world. Now, when they went, before they went into the Holy Land, they organized in Greece, and they were also in Constantinople, and they were gathering esoteric belief system, any kind of paperwork they could, any kind of scrolls, any kind of documents. They were initiated under the Druze and Sufi. So they were very familiar with all the initiation processes. What they had intended to do was go back into Europe, into the main area of mainland in Europe, start this country in Portugal as a template for what they wanted to do was bring about this change, this enlightenment period, this period of enlightenment, and share all of this esoteric knowledge with the masses. Well, it was bad timing because that's when the Catholic Church was just getting going. And of course, you know, we now had the Inquisition and everything else was happening.
Yeah.
But they were able to get involved with inside in the countries. They were the bankers for all the monarchs, every single one of them. I found that they banked every single one of the monarchs and all of the noble families throughout the whole entire continent of Europe and into the UK. So what it tells me is that when they were traveling, they were setting, I think that they were setting intention, if you want to put it that way, in other countries to eventually branch out into these other countries and eventually bring this new idea of a world, a new world, I guess you would call it, of harmony, of equality, into, this is what they wanted to do, is bring this into existence. This is why they teamed up with Bernard de Clairvaux, because Bernard de Clairvaux was the head of the Cistercian movement, and what that movement was about was to clean out the corruption in the Catholic Church. So they were trying, I think at some point, they were trying to actually clean up the Catholic Church and at the same time, you know, bring about this ideal that they had, this agenda that they had to bring about a better world based on these esoteric belief systems that they had uncovered while they were in Greece, in Constantinople, and in the Holy Land. And I firmly believe this now. And then later, you know, they were involved in the Magna Carta, and they, and that, of course, is what, that's what, you know, our rules and laws over here in the United States are based on. So, eventually, which was brought, you know, of course, the Masons. That was the Masons' baby. But who were the Masons? The Masons studied the Templar initiations. They did all the same initiations as what the Templars had. They had all the same beliefs that were passed down. If they weren't, you know, descendants of Templar families, they certainly were understudies of the Templars' belief systems and, you know, ideals. And the United States of America was built on a foundation that was initially inspired by the Templars.
Yeah. Yeah. And by that, once again, cause of enlightenment and the idea of inclusion of all religions and all religious thought.
Absolutely.
You know, the consideration of the capital G creator God, not the Judeo-Christian God, things like that. And even the idea of the unfinished pyramid, being what it represented for them, which is the idea of, you know, it's never finished because your temple is never finished. You should be learning till the day you die, you know, the idea of that, the esoteric concept behind that.
Right. It's an individual evolution as, you know, in addition to collective consciousness rising and consciousness evolution, you know, mankind on a collective level as well as an individual level. So,
yeah.
You know, so this is ongoing, and they were well aware of this. And, you know, I've also had several conversations with Timothy Hogan, which have been very enlightening, and found out, you know, that my research, when I went back into the second building of the temple in Jerusalem in 600 and something B.C., Zerubbabel organized the Danites to protect the builders of that temple. And so I had uncovered in Portugal, it looked like one of the families was the same families that originated, that were the origin of the Templars in 1118. So we think that they're the same, and Timothy agreed with me. He said, yeah, they're absolutely the same, which would explain why they knew exactly where to go. I mean, we have these nine knights, which I found that there was actually 11. We have these 11 knights that all came from affluent families, wealthy families, and here they go into Jerusalem, and they could have stayed in the castle, but why? They didn't stay in the castle. Where'd they stay? They stayed in the dilapidated stables. Why? Because they were right directly under, over the top of where the Temple Mount. And the first thing they did was to build a tunnel, dig out a tunnel, and excavate that whole area underneath the Temple Mount. Yeah. So I think that, you know, generation, talking about passing things down generationally, this is what happened. And I firmly believe that many of the same families that Zerubbabel put together as knights to protect the builders, they would have been, of course, they would have been privy to the whole entire architectural design at that point. They were protecting these builders. So, you know, it's, it makes a perfect sense that these things would have been passed down to their descendants. And then, of course, you know, that when they get the chance to go to the Holy Land, what's the first thing they do? They go right down into the, you know, right down in the stables and underneath the Temple Mount. So
yeah, yeah, precisely. And you know, it, even the fact of, like you were saying, because of course most people would be like, once again, 1119, that was the founding of the Knights Templar, you know, but this information that you're talking about, caves and things going back to 1090, that changes everything. Kathleen, that's almost 100 years. That is a large, because once again, people think that they were like a hobbled group of brother knights and things like that, that they didn't really have a lot of power, that they amassed this power during, like, okay, if they did that, then they just like sprung into power is what happened. And if you have from 1090 till then to quietly assemble and do what you're going to do and have families, you know, give fortune and sons to the cause, quietly, then yeah, you've had almost a hundred years to amass this army and amass this power and amass the knowledge enough and the Navy enough even to go to Brazil to mount that expedition.
And then you have to remember that, you know, the king in Portugal, King Denis, at the time that King Philip the Fair rounded everybody up in France, I'm beginning to see what my research is showing me is that, you know, France appears to be the facade or the facade power structure of the Templars. You know, everybody thought that that was the primary headquarters. I think that the primary headquarters was actually in Portugal. I think the power was in Portugal, and what the nuts and bolts and what was really going on in terms of furthering their agenda to bring about a better world, that was all in Portugal. And they were furthering that all the way back to 1090. I firmly believe that they're back and forth. Now, I've uncovered some research, with some people in the Azores. There's an old family in the Azores, and apparently there's some records of one of the family members that was a Templar, leaving the Azores sometime in the 11th or 12th century, excuse me, early 12th century, beginning of 1100s, and, following the path of the crows into South America, the immigration path. Now, I haven't been able to find anything else on this except for this one document that we've uncovered over there. But it makes sense, and it shows a much earlier departure than, you know, the one has been, that what's been accepted by the historic record. So, you know, there's just everything pointing to a much earlier date, and everything pointing to the fact that what was really the most important things that were happening within the Templar movement were happening in Portugal, not necessarily in France. Mm.
That is so interesting. And once again, changes the face of what we know about the Templars.
Yeah.
The date range.
The Portuguese, typically they're not a people that you know walks down and you know beats the drum and tells everybody who they are. You know, that's typically just not who they are anyway.
Yeah.
And from what we're finding out is the king kept this knowledge of South America secret for several hundred years. He told all the other monarchs, he told everybody else that South America, well, that wasn't even known, that word, that wasn't even known. He led everybody to believe that he had a ship that went out and they discovered an island, and they called the island Veracruz, so that nobody suspected there was an entire continent.
Yeah. That is.
And
that
in the
is...
meantime, he's got whole fleets going over there back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, bringing back gold, bringing back silver. You know, so he managed the monarchs in Portugal. You know, they were, if you look at that time frame, then the building and all the things that were going on at that time, I mean, they must have had what would be equivalent to billions of dollars, you know, yeah, today in today's money, that they had access to. And we're continually putting it into buildings and naval fleets and, you know, everything else.
Yeah, because once
the rest of the monarchs, they were barely supporting the Crusades, you know. And like, yeah, I said, when after the fall of Acre, I mean, they were dead broke.
Well, was this going on during the time of the Crusades as well? Have you been able to track that?
Yeah. Yeah, during the Crusades. You know, in Portugal, at least, they were traveling. They were traveling by ship. We found evidence, looks like, this is later evidence, though, but it appears there's some Templar Knights of Christ crosses on a port in India, that I haven't seen personally, but I'm going to be going over to see, that I've been told about, and I have, pictures were sent to me, so I have some photos. And so, you know, I mean, they were traveling all over the place, Chris, all over the place. They were in North America. We know that, you know, we know that the Sinclair, family, they supported a couple of trips over to North America. And this was in the 13th century. 14th century. But early in the 1300s, and we have Scott Walter has a date of 1323 or something like that, I think. Anyway, and he's doing some phenomenal research right now too, my God. But he's opened up on this last episode that they had, he had the Timothy Hogan, Secrets of the Knights Templar. It's out on YouTube.
Mm.
My God, he got that axis that he had uncovered and decoded. He was able to find the cipher and decode all these documents. And I mean, these are phenomenal. These are absolutely phenomenal. So this agenda that they have had dates way back to before they were ever organized. This agenda to bring about a world and, you know, of equality, that goes much further back. And so they were inspired by these original documents, these original texts and things that they uncovered. But, there's just some great stuff coming out, right? You know, in the next, I foresee the next, 50 years, 20 years, maybe. I mean, we're going to completely overturn a lot of things that we've, you know, typically believed were history that are not. They're not facts.
Well, and that's just it. We are regularly changing that. So many things history-wise have been pushed back. Dates have been pushed back. Things have utterly changed. I mean, even the concept of when feet first hit North America natively has changed in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So the ideas of, once again, that Native Americans in that area talk about having met Knights Templar, things like that, the ideas of them having come to America, having come to South America.
They're symbols. I mean, if you look on some of their older pottery, you see Templar crosses, for Christ's sake, and they're even red, you know. So, you know, and this is the same story that I get from the Amazonian tribes in South America and Brazil. Same story. They shared an initiation. They probably shared ayahuasca, for all we know. But they definitely shared symbolism. They shared ideology. They were definitely compatible with each other enough to where the Amazonians were the ones that brought the Templars from Bahia into Alto Paraíso.
Now, what would they have, aside from gold, things like that? Because once again, if they were carrying this on during the crusade as well, they have ulterior plans aside from just bringing gold back for the king, things like that?
Well, I think that they were, you know, basically stashing money away for a time, an opportunity when they could actually fund their dream, you know, and I really think, you know, I personally believe, and I know a lot of people are going to really not probably want to hear it, but I personally believe that, you know, the treasure in Oak Island was used, and it was Templar treasure. I believe it was used during the Revolutionary War.
That is not the first time I have heard that hypothesis put forth.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one, right? This hypothesis has been forwarded by a number of people. I think Scott is even on board with that one.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it just makes sense to me. you know, when something doesn't ring true to me for whatever reason, I'm always on board with what is logically sensible, what makes sense. Yeah. What human nature, you know, what people are going to do. And if they had conceived this idea of creating a nation here in the United States of America, you know, with the Bill of Rights and all these things that mirrored the Magna Carta, right?
Mm.
Do you think that they would have forgot about how they were going to fund it? No, that would have been an integral piece of the plan. And I think that, you know, that they had, I think, made a lot of this money that funded the Revolutionary War. I know we got a lot of money from France as well. But I think it was probably Templar treasure that did it, that funded a lot of that.
Well, and, you know, when you start looking at specifically the countries involved with funding the United States, it makes a lot of sense. You know, they were definitely countries heavily tied to Templar.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, you know, look, we got the Statue of Liberty from France, you know, and you know, I think that's why all eyes are on us right now. They want to see what's going to happen, you know, with the democracy. Is it going to survive this, what's going on right now? Well, that remains to be seen. We have survived for over 200 years. So, you know, I mean, it stands to reason that we will. And we're going to go through an upheaval, which we need to. We need it to. Anyway, we really, you know, this country, we're at that point where, you know, we need to shake things up. Things need to be shaken up. So we're going to get a shakeup.
Well, and you know, there's a reason why the founding fathers called it the Great Experiment. You know, yeah. it is an ongoing experiment. The experiment never stops. Because through observation and through gathering of data, we come up with more hypotheses and change the equation all the time, Kathleen.
It's evolving as the human species evolves, you know, and that's the beauty of, you know, that's the beauty of this country, and that's the beauty of the founders, that what they foresaw for this country was a continual evolutionary process, and we would shift and change and allow for that to take place and unfold organically, you know. So I think, you know, I'm just sitting back and I'm wondering, you know, and I'm waiting to see what kind of changes are going to take place. And I believe in, you know, because you know me, I've always had a very firm belief in our creator, you know. My personal belief is you shit or get off the pot. You either believe that there's a God that has all power or you don't.
Yeah.
And if you do believe that there's a God that has all power, well, then you believe that there's a plan and that plan is unfolding, and it may not make any flippin' sense to us. I'm sure it didn't make any sense to Anne Boleyn when she was getting beheaded, but I'll tell you what, if it hadn't been for Anne Boleyn, she was absolutely pivotal in what happened later with the Enlightenment.
Probably didn't make a lot of sense to Jacques de Molay at the time.
Exactly. If it had not been for Anne Boleyn and, you know, Henry VIII's obsession with her, he would never thrown off the shackles of the Catholic Church. And that was the beginning of that happening all across Europe. And of course, that was also the foundation of what the founders came over here in the United States. You know, that's what their foundation was throwing off the shackles of the Catholic Church. It had to happen. But, you know, if you talk to Anne Boleyn about that at the time, I'm sure she wasn't very happy about it. But you see what I'm saying? We can't judge by the circumstances and what we see going on around us. We have to look from the big picture, trust in God that there is a plan and that something is unfolded that's bigger than we are, and just stand for our beliefs. I'm not saying we abandon our beliefs and just lay back and let it all happen. No, we don't do that. But we do have to, you know, allow for that big picture to take seed and to unfold.
Yeah.
And I think that's a challenge, you know, that's the challenge today that we all have. We have to take responsibility individually for our country. We love this country. We have to take responsibility for the choices and the things that it takes to keep this country going. So, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more involvement from the population, you know, in the near future, because everybody's going to realize.
Are you
just
still
how
there,
much
Kathleen?
This country needs. Huh?
Sorry. Sorry, I just had my headphone die and had to rewire it on the fly. Gremlins, man, I'm telling you, I don't know what's up. But quite literally, like you were saying earlier, that is the Templar dream. That was what they were experimenting with, the original experiment, Portugal, where once again you had men and women almost elevated to the same point. You had multiple religions living next to each other, okay with each other, you know, that kind of stuff. And that was extraordinarily challenging to the regime at the time, which, yes, was the Catholic Church.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Catholic Church was champing at the bit to get into Portugal, but it couldn't because, you know, we had Templar, all the kings of Portugal, they knew what their positions were. Plus, they were getting all this gold from the Templars. I mean, are they going to turn around, stab them in the back, and turn them over to the Catholic Church? Hell no. They're not going to do that. They're going to support them to the very last. They're going to continue to support the Templars and the dream and, you know, everything that they were doing in Portugal. So, You know, when the Catholic Church did finally get in there during the Inquisition in the 1500s, the first thing they did was move into Tomar and just, you know, desecrate everything. And
yeah.
And then everybody thought, okay, well, then that's the end of the Templars. Well, it wasn't the end of the Templars, because I've met numerous Templars now in both Portugal and Brazil who are blood descendants of the Templars that were supposedly annihilated during the early 1300s. And they continued on as the Knights of Christ. And they eventually, many of them left the order, had married, had family, especially in Brazil this happened. And we now have many, many descendants that are directly related to some of the, you know, some of the original Templars. So,
So
they just basically went underground after that. You know, when the Inquisition came into Portugal, they basically went underground. So you got to remember that's in the late 1500s to 1600s. And what happened at that point? Then we see the advent of the Masonic orders popping up all over the place, right? So, you know, I mean, if we really look at the timeline, it makes sense. It just makes sense that these things happened and unfolded the way they did. And, you know, and like I was there in 2019 for the reorganization and reunification of the International Templar Order in Tomar. I was there for the procession, and I was there for, well, I didn't see the signing of the documents, but I was there for the celebration and the procession that followed to celebrate the signing of that document. So here we are 700 years later, and the Templar Order is larger, it's bigger than it ever was.
And that is awesome to see that, you know, once again, people have been able to blood trace their relation back to the original families, back to an unbroken trail to Templars that escaped, things like that, and that they have continued the order to this day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, when I hear when people say, well, the Templars died out. No, they never did. They never did. From everything that I can see, they never did. You know, somebody just sent me some photos today that it looks like I'm going to get into Austria, Germany, and Latvia and some of those Germanic countries. There's a castle over there in Latvia that what the rumors are is that underneath the castle, there were Templars built tunnels that went to all the castles that connected underground. So it appears that the Templars literally went underground, and just about, we have the same thing in England, we have the same thing in Scotland, we have the same thing in Portugal, we have the same thing in France. These underground tunnel systems and caves that they were still conducting their initiations, they were still meeting, they were still moving forward with their agenda, they were keeping their, you know, all their laws and all their rules and everything alive for a later date, you know. And that's what they've done. That's exactly what they've done. And now is the time, you know, for, now's the time. I mean, we actually have the possibility of bringing about a better world. You know, we just moved into it. I think it was today or yesterday. We just moved into the Aquarian. Aquarius entered Pluto, I believe, is and I think that was today. So, you know, so things are going to start shifting energetically, and I think we're going to see some huge changes, because that is going to maintain that Aquarian age, whatever you want to call it, but that Aquarius and Pluto is going to go all the way until 2044. So we've got 20 years of you know, this beautiful energy that says it supports, you know, a new age, a raising of consciousness. It supports the things that, again, are aligned with the Templar agenda.
Well, and once again, goes to numerous esoteric teachings and calendars and ancient calendars that talked about this era and this time being a time of major shift and change, I mean, that was the whole thing behind the Mayan calendar. It wasn't that the world was going to end. It was that the age ended and we entered a new age of how do we apply this technology during the nighttime of civilization over the next 33,000 years, you know? And that's where we're at right now, trying to figure that out. How do we figure out AI? How do we figure out getting ourselves to the moon, getting ourselves to Mars, things like that? These are the hot topics of conversation right now, you know, and it's amazing to see that.
Right. Well, what we have to keep in mind is that we need to maintain a balance with technology and our spiritual evolutionary growth. There's got to be a balance. We can't move forward with technology and basically push our spirituality by the wayside, because that's just not going to work. We will destroy ourselves. So, you know, we have to maintain that balance. It's vital that
absolutely.
We have to maintain a respect, mutual respect and interdependence with the natural world, with the earth and with the animals and everything and plants and everything around us. We really have to, revive our respect and interdependence. You know, when I was in India, I saw that interdependence with nature that they have. Mm. And it's just really phenomenal. It's really beautiful. When I travel to different places, I see these wonderful things that I think, gosh, if we could just take that piece from here and this piece from there and this piece from over here, you know, it really is going to take a pool of everybody of all cultures in order to bring this together. And what a beautiful world, you know, what a beautiful opportunity we have.
Well, and that's just it. You know, once again, to go back to that Templar concept, even the idea of, you know, you are the unfinished temple. Never forget that you're not finished. You won't be finished. You're supposed to grow. You're supposed to adopt these concepts. You're supposed to grow in them, you know? It's great to see even the idea that, you know, without a good foundation of yourself and what that unfinished temple of you is, yes, the world can dominate over you. Technology can dominate over you, you know, so you need that good foundation of self spiritually.
Well, see, this is where I think the esoteric belief systems, because with each one of these belief systems, I don't care which one, pick one. It doesn't matter to me, because within that belief system is a series of steps, initiation steps that one must have to go through to purify basically your mind, your body, your your soul, whatever you want to call it. But it starts with self-reflection, and it's vital in this time that we're in right now that every individual adopts. In fact, I just started a TikTok, and I call it the Grail Quest.
Yep.
And it's the level that it takes to get out onto your own Grail Quest.
Yeah.
And these are the same levels. These are the same principles that we see in the Sufi beliefs, in the Templar beliefs, in the Masonic beliefs. What I'm teaching is encapsulated in these levels that I'm teaching on TikTok right now.
That's great.
Up to the fifth level. I just introduced the fifth level a few days ago. But I think that it's vital that each person develops that ability to self-reflect and to work on themselves.
That's right.
You can't change the world until we change ourselves. We cannot make an impact because we have nothing to give. We have nothing to share until we go with ourselves.
Well, even the idea of you can't change the world around you. Should you change the world around you, or should you change the way you look at and react to the world around you? You know,
that's a big part of it. You know, I mean, and the first part of that whole thing is we don't have the right to tell other people how to live their life. You know, that is not our right. What we need to be doing is living our life the way that we think is the best or whatever, that, according to the belief system that we have, and be examples of that. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing fingers pointed instead, and we're seeing people saying, oh, well, we know everything. We're going to tell you how to live, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And that isn't how it works. That is not how it works.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we may have to move closer to the edge. You know, we may have to see some chaos, and we may have to see some destruction before people are going to finally get it. I don't know. But it begins with the individual, and it begins with every single individual. Every single individual has got to adopt and understand that they have to adopt certain principles that are going to make them a better person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
And especially
and doing. Well, in doing that, because and one person does that, and then you have 10 people that are influenced by that person, and 10 more people do it, and then you've got, you know, 10 times those people that they've interacted with, and chances are, you know, you can really make an impact, but you've got to make those changes yourself first.
That's right.
You know, I mean, we can't be standing there on our little soapbox and tell everybody what to do, because that's not how it works.
Yeah. Well, and the idea of, once again, of that is the Grail quest. Kathleen,
yes,
that is the charge that every Templar put themselves in front of, was to have themselves prepared to touch and retrieve the Grail for humanity.
Exactly.
You know, and until we're ready to be able to touch that Grail, you know, will we be ready? You know, and are you ready come the opportunity? You know?
Right. Exactly.
So, but, yeah, the idea of how do we get ourselves to that point? How do we, because that journey is different for everybody. What works for one person, does not necessarily work for the next, you know? So it's a mutual journey of everybody to meet everyone where everyone is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it can begin with something as little as walking out to the creek daily, or make an appointment with yourself and say that you're going to go out to the creek and do a meditation once a week or something. It can start with something as simple as that.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to start meditating every day, and it's when I first get up for 15. That's what I do personally. But you know, I mean, it can start with, you know what? I'm going to make that plane flight for Istanbul or Egypt, or I'm going to make that flight. I'm going to actually do it. And I've always wondered, there's been something inside that's drawing me. I'm going to do it. And I know these are the ways that we step out of our comfort zone into our own Grail quest.
That's it.
And this is what I've been talking about more and more, because
it's what we need.
There's a tremendous amount of fulfillment in that. And it's also refining in itself.
Yeah.
You automatically begin to go along the path of initiation just by being on a Grail quest.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And I mean, I've started, I guess, in the last about 3 months, started doing a 15 minute a day meditation where it's spread across. It's only 5 minutes in the morning. And it's literally 5 1-minute short little thought meditations of, you know, in the morning, it's five things you love. In the afternoon, it's five things that love you, that you think about for a minute each. And you can do that while, you know, I mean, think of your kid, think of your dog, you know, doesn't matter if you think of your dog every day, if you think of your dog every day for a minute and how much they love you and how much you are loved by them. And then in the evening, five ways you can love better, you know, it's tiny little things like that, that change literally the frequency of your thought, the way that you think in slow and steady ways.
Exactly. It completely shifts your reality. And that's what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
You want to get your reality, shift your reality. And as you're doing that, you shift your entire frequency that you're radiating out to others, because there's a certain joy. You know, I have people come up to me all the time. I want to do what you do. I want to do what you do. And I say, oh gosh, okay, well, you know, so that's why I'm doing this TikTok thing now.
That's
because,
great. I'm so happy for you.
People ask, you know, what did you do? How did you get to where where you're at? And it just starts with a decision to begin with, and facing the fears of stepping out on that limb and you know, walking out on that limb and continuing to walk out on that limb, and realize that that limb is going to continue to grow into your feet no matter how far you take.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, the fact of you're human, you're going to fail, it's going to be okay, you know, lately my 7-year-old has been taking part in this like a quarter mile race every week.
Yeah.
For like 6 weeks. I guess it's a half mile, actually. It's a pretty decent race. It's one of those, like, wow, I don't know if Dad could hop in there and run a half mile with you, bud. But it's been great to see my 7-year-old not have the want of competition with other 7-year-olds. But have the concern of whether or not he finishes the race.
Exactly.
You know? Not keeping up with the Joneses, but did I keep up with myself? You know?
Right. If we could get away from that idea of competing,
yeah,
and just get, this is what I have to focus on, honestly, with what I'm doing now. I have to just focus on what I can do to further my agenda and to continue to reach out to people and share my message and my research. Is just pay attention to my own path. I can't look at other people because, you know, I mean, the circumstances are not the same.
Yeah.
And if we can stay away from that competitiveness.
That's it.
It's so ingrained in our society. I mean, worldwide.
It is.
There's that, you know, that competing.
Yeah, it's not even about
really, but if you go into the indigenous cultures in the Amazon jungle or in Africa or many of the indigenous Native America, they don't do that.
No.
They don't compete. That's not the point.
Yeah.
The point is your own individual growth. And are you sharing something? Are you sharing something of yourself with other people?
Yeah.
You know, what is your experience about? I can't remember what it was, but not long ago, there was this big athletic thing and it was a race, I think, and the person was going to win and they stopped to help somebody behind them that had fallen.
Yeah.
And so impressed with that. Did you see that on the news?
Yeah, that was an Olympic race.
Like a I think it might. I think you might even posted it. But because I had all your stuff, you know, all your posts. But I was so impressed with that. Because that's
humanity. That's humanity. You know, and it's not about. It's about helping somebody else finish the race. You know, it's about what can we do. Because even like I've been talking about at conferences and on shows with Curious Research, Kathleen, research does not happen in a vacuum. It can't. Right. By definition, it can't. Science can't happen in a vacuum. So none of this research can happen in a vacuum. You don't want competition or healthy competition between researchers. What you want is healthy cooperation, healthy community. Where people feel welcomed with their ideas and their thought forms, where we can come and exchange ideas in an open forum and not be in a competitive nature to get the headlight out on some research and take it from somebody and things like that, you know? Because it's destructive to communities. B, it stymies the research. Now nobody wants to share data because somebody went out and took data from somebody and published it and said it was theirs, you know? And it happens all the time. Happens all the time.
It does. And the root of this is that same thing. It's this we're trained from a very young age to compete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trained to win at all, no matter what.
At all costs.
It means to violate our own ethics to do so. You know,
precisely.
We're seeing the epitome of that, you know, going on in our country right now. And, you know, we really need to move beyond that. We really need to develop empathy, compassion for our fellow men. We need to think of ourselves as a group. It's that, you know, what is it? Michael Tillinger, the Ubuntu idea.
Yeah.
I love that. I just love it. And I've known Michael for, God, since I had my radio show back in, my television show back in Jackson, back in, 2009 or so. And he introduced that idea to me. I absolutely fell in love with that idea because that is really what we need to adopt as a world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as a world population, a collective ideal that we all embrace, instead of just competing, because this is getting us nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it once again does, it only tears communities apart, and it does not help but stymie research in these fields.
Right.
You know, when people are in active competition with each other, imagine what we could do if the five people sat down in a room and compared and contrasted research openly without fear of somebody taking their research, you know.
Right.
It'd be amazing.
You know, this is what I've been able to do with certain people. You know, I've been able to do this with Scott.
Sure.
Walter, I've been able to do this with Timothy Hogan. I've been able to do this with...
there are definitely, you know, civilized researchers out there. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, and, you know, and Gretchen Cornwall, I've been able to do this with her, and I've been able to do this, you know, with another gal in Ireland. She's in Ireland now. But, you know, I mean, I have been able to, I sort of handpick, I seem to connect with the right people.
You definitely have to feel that out.
Are the same type, they have the same kind of ethics I do.
That's
they believe in sharing. They believe in the community.
Yeah.
You know, sharing the research that we have. It's not this big competition of who's going to, because nobody's going to win.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to win.
Yeah.
We're all contributing to the world knowledge, to the knowledge that goes out to the masses. We are all participating in contributing because that's our gift.
That's right.
That's what we were gifted with to share with the world.
Absolutely. And I love sharing your message and the message of this and the message of the Templars with my audience every time you're on. It's always great, Kathleen. I love our conversations. They need to happen much more often than they do. I'm so glad that you're back.
I really miss it. I really miss it. I was really excited about tonight. Actually.
Absolutely.
Really,
same.
Really
same. It's been a long, long time. And I mean, I know you've been in Tomar and traveling and researching and hip deep in things. So I have been Google stalking you from afar. but we will definitely make it a whole lot more regular now that you are back. Before we let you go, make sure everybody knows where they can go to follow Templars in Brazil, where they can go to follow you on TikTok, everything else.
Okay. So, you know, the core of my research, and the documentary updates and everything, will be on my website, which is www.templarsinbrazil.com, just like it sounds. I'm also on Facebook. I have the Templars in Brazil Facebook, and I also have Kathleen Ann Ball, Ann with an E. You can look me up on Facebook. I'm on TikTok, The Grail Quest. And that's where I'm doing that series of levels of how you start a Grail Quest. How do you continue? How do you get to where you want to be? That's all on TikTok. I just opened an account on Blue Sky, and that's just skyrocketed, taken off like crazy.
Yeah.
And that's under Kathleen Ball, PhD. And then I'm also on Instagram, and I have a YouTube channel, a Grail Quest YouTube channel. So I have a few, I think I've got 5 or 6 YouTube. I think I've got 5 or 6 on there right now. And I'm talking about, you know, the different countries and the different things and some of the stuff that I've done on my research trips, and talk about the Amazon jungle. I talk about ayahuasca. I talk about near-death experiences. I'm talking about all sorts of things that have been, you know, included in my path along the way.
Yeah.
Of where, of, you know, how I've arrived to how I am, who I am today.
Well,
but anyways,
we need
so those
to-
are some ways. And then my film is still on Gaia. The Brazilian Templar's Mystery is still on Gaia. We have another one coming up that's going to be episode 2 of the Brazilian Templar's Mystery, and that will be shopped to Film Hub.
Great.
So I don't know where that's going to come out, but it'll be, you know, one of them. And then my second book, my first book, is A Grail Quest and Discovery of a Mysterious Knights Templar Cave in Brazil. And my second book that I'm working on now will be out next year. And that is just simply The Templar Agenda.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks again, as always, for coming on, Kathleen. It's always great having you on, talking about this stuff. And really, really game-changing material, man. Like, the discovery of the cave is one thing, but the redating of stuff is just massively huge. Massively. So congratulations on that. And I look forward to hearing so many more updates and to having you on after the release of the movie. Thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. It's been sheer joy. I really enjoyed it, Chris. Thank
Same
you.
Here. We'll catch up again very soon. I'll talk to you soon, Kathleen.
Okay. Sounds
All right.
good, Chris. Have
Take
a great
care.
Night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Always great talking with Kathleen Ball. She is an amazing researcher. And once again, she gets hip deep into things like beyond books. She is out in the field, out researching these things, following the bloodline of surviving Templars across the globe. It's absolutely awesome to see. While you are online, checking out everything from Dr. Kathleen Ball at TemplarsInBrazil.com, make sure to stop on by Symposium of the Strange. Symposium of the Strange happens tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, November 20th, in San Antonio at the Magic Time Machine. Fantastic family restaurant. We will be talking with the Klinga brothers there. They will be presenting about hauntings in Texas and haunted places in Texas that they have experienced during their time as paranormal investigators. So come on out. Check that out, folks. Of course, while you're online, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find CuriousRealm.com/videos, where we have all of the video channels from YouTube of our guests, including Kathleen Ball, embedded there for you to be able to find. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friends Mike Turber from 5x5 News, as well as Earl Gray from MUFON. We will be talking about the recent Senate panels from the Oversight Committee on UFO, UAP, what the sideways confirmation of a crash retrieval program means. What having a rear admiral there testifying means, what the next step toward disclosure are. We'll be getting into all of those things, as well as the community at large impact of these hearings, when we come back from this commercial break with our good friends Earl Gray Anderson and Mike Turber, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, This easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for hanging on through that. And also thank you so much to our sponsors, especially TruHemp Science. If you are a CBD user as I am, stop on by and check out TruHemp Science. TruHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Use the code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles on the way out the door as well. Our guests in this segment are Earl Gray, the head of Southern California, well, state director of California MUFON, as well as head of Southern California MUFON, as well as our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We will be talking about the recent Senate panel, the Oversight Committee panel on UFO UAPs. There was some great testimony given there. We're going to be talking about some of the community reaction, as well as what many of the statements mean. We will be playing clips from the actual panel, stuff like that. Before we get started with that, though, we do have a clip from Pentagon Deputy Spokesperson Sabrina Singh, who held a press briefing regarding that panel. Her question and answer here is interesting. So let's get into that real quick.
Can you talk a little more about the unidentified aerial phenomena? And one of the accusations, it's not in the report, but that the department has within storage the remains of aliens or signs of life from elsewhere. Can you settle that once and for all? Do you or don't you have such remains?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of any remains that the department has of, you know, any signs of extraterrestrial beings or activity or technology. And I'm sorry, what was your second question or your first question?
Well, it's really about that. And then also what the top line finding in this report.
So the report, again, was briefed to staff and committee members were notified about the report. Part of this annual report submitted to Congress is accountability and to ensure that we continue to keep members updated through our Aero office. Go ahead.
But have you found any evidence of foreign involvement in any of these unidentified aerial phenomena?
Yeah. To date, the department has not discovered any verifiable evidence of extraterrestrial beings, activity, or technology, nor verifiable information to substantiate claims that, you know, any programs regarding possession or reverse engineering of extraterrestrial materials have existed in the past or currently exist.
Okay. And in terms of the strikes on the...
Now, I found that to be a very, very interesting clip coming on the heels of these hearings. We don't know here at the Pentagon about any programs to retrieve anything or anything like that. Well, I mean, I don't know. There were definitely documents signed not to talk about retrieval programs. It also came up in the Senate hearing that there were public admissions to people being paid compensatory wages for being harmed by the technology recovered in the recovery programs.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah. You can't say that the recovery programs exist on hand A, but in hand B, you can totally pay somebody for their injuries that happened while they were recovering these materials. You know, like,
you
can totally publicly admit that.
You know, she should have ended that by saying, "Oh, and if we did, we wouldn't tell you anyway."
Yeah, so, yeah.
Exactly.
I find it interesting because that is exactly how they revealed Area 51 to the public.
Yeah,
was compensatory damages from surrounding communities from the off burning of stealth materials, you know, in trenches and stuff like that. So. Yeah, Bill Clinton had to come out and say, like, yes, this facility actively exists. You know,
it's Chris,
called Area 51. Yeah.
It's very interesting because, you know, my background and, you know, the reason why I'm interested even remotely in this is because my mom used to work for the military industrial complex back in the 1950s. And she wound up having recurring cancers that dogged her through her entire life. It finally, sadly, took my mom's life in 1999. And the conversation was, you know, this had just come out with the Area 51 thing about the lawsuits. And I told my mom, I said, you know, your doctor said that these were not metastatic cancers, that it appeared that you had been radiated somehow. And why don't we lawyer up and let's go for them? Because, you know, they didn't compensate my mom that well. She got a little trip, like a 3-month vacation in London every single year. And that was, I said, you know, that's not worth your life, Mom. And her whole attitude was, son, I'm proud of what I did. I knew that there were risks. Like a soldier, I'm a patriot. And I went in knowing those risks. I would never sue my government. And that was the end of the conversation. But I tried to get my mom to go on record about this very thing back then. And, you know, that's I think that, you know, you have to think about like the Cash Landrum case, right, where there were three family members that were, again, irradiated by this strange diamond shaped object.
Yeah, there was spewing material out,
you know,
spewing material.
Rocketdyne, you know, I mean, we know they were working on that sort of thing, but this thing, you know, harmed them.
Yeah.
And talking to John Schussler, who was the main investigator on that case, he did confirm to me he thought that perhaps this was like the Flying Pumpkin Seed or one of the atomic powered rockets that we'd been working on that got away and it harmed them.
Yeah, because there were numerous attempts very early on of atomic bombers, atomic battleships. It was atomic everything was the attempt.
Yeah,
very, very much.
Only seems to work on Navy vessels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's the thing is that the Navy programs go thick and deep when it comes to technology, and some of that we'll get into in some of the testimony, specifically the USO testimony. One of the things that I found amazing, and a lot of the community, this is a good time before we get into the first clips to really talk about the way that the community has received not only the continued hearings, but this hearing in particular. I heard a lot of things, you know, from across the pond, even of, absolutely nothing useful or new presented. And it's like, well, you know, I don't really see a whole lot of parliamentary hearings going on about releases of data over there. But at the same token, no, I think that there was definitely, some new revelations made, some new confirmations of things, even in the confirmed denial of things, you know, like that is something that me and Mike Turber talk about regularly is that proper lingo speak of, you know, I can neither confirm nor deny that,
you know, heard that
things
times.
Like that, things like Lou Elizondo saying, oh no, I signed a document saying that I would not talk about crash retrievals.
And then about next, that.
Isn't that an admission that crash retrievals exist? I can't say that. Is. you know, like,
yeah. And then her very next question is, did you or are you aware of the government having any crash retrieval programs? And he says, yes. He immediately answered the question after he said he was only answering.
Yeah. But he can't talk about them. Hilarious. I mean, he can say that they're there because, well, he signed a document. There's a legal document that could be found. You know, it's in a skiff. So it can be found through FOIA request, the document that he signed. But that's even something else that was gotten into is the denial of and blocking of FOIA requests. You know, that was heavily brought up and hugely important, you know, to be made known publicly. Go ahead, Mike.
I was saying I've been pretty lucky with my FOIA requests. Greenwald has had luck, and then he would run up against a stone wall. And a lot of it had to do with terminology and knowing exactly where to look, not necessarily what to look for. And that became an issue. But with Lou's books, his book coming through Dopser and his releasing of information inside of his book and being told what he can and can't talk about. Borderlines, some questions have to be raised when he answers the question that he was asked at that meeting. And we'll get into that. If you have that clip, it'll be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll get to that clip most definitely. And, you know, as somebody swimming hip deep in the UFO UAP community role, what has been your overall reception of how people have taken this in?
I didn't expect anything, quite honestly. I'm kind of famous for telling my field investigators at MUFON, you know, you guys are disclosure. If we get something from the government, well, oh boy, that's great. You know, that's a cherry on top. But, my mom told me two different times during my life, you know, this is a very real phenomenon and they will never ever tell the public.
Yeah.
And that was, she doubled down on that. And so I'm so surprised to see anything coming out that I wonder how my mom would react to it. I wonder if she would be thrilled, horrified, or because she spent her whole life, you know, trying. I mean, she messed up with her NDAs because she didn't think I would remember something she told me when I was 5 years old. And I kept, to her horror, bringing it up. And in fact, I talked about it in front of a fourth grade school class.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, my mom worked in an underground facility and she says that UFOs and aliens are very real. And my mom, I heard later on from somebody who was in the DOD, they just told me, you know, I've read your mother's file. It's like, she has a file. Of course she has a file. And you know that she reported on herself. You gave a little lecture when you were in grammar school, didn't you, Earl? It's like, wow. They know about that. So, I mean, you know, it's a big deal, you know, in breaking your NDAs. You just don't do that. You'll go to prison. So I think that what Lou is doing, it's very bold. It's very heroic. It's a risk for him. He could lose his pension. It could be worse. He could lose his livelihood. And I mean, look, I'm very happy now that I did actually pony up for a copy of this eminent that was signed and inscribed because and people were spouting hatred about the man, you know, on Twitter.
They always will.
But, you know, I mean, I didn't expect anything like this. He's doing it.
And that's just it. You know, even hearing from Gold, who used to work at NASA, now works for Red Fly Aerospace, things like that. Even hearing from him about the ridicule that NASA scientists, once they started getting involved, because like at the second NASA panel, the head had to get up beforehand to be like, okay, guys, seriously, are we going to be like threatening NASA scientists on social media? Wow. Like you can't for decades say that we aren't willing to be involved and aren't willing to investigate. And then once we get into the investigation, start saying that we are part of an all-consuming conspiracy and hate us, you know, like it doesn't encourage scientists who want to be involved with your cause. It doesn't help.
Yeah, the social media and internet is definitely a battlefield that is not for the faint of heart. So,
yeah, no.
And, you know, a lot of times when people are injected into that with a very solid background and you know, in the scientific community and what have you, and then these people out of the woodwork start doing that, what they do, the trolls and so forth, and it's very difficult to try to, you know, you almost want to take someone that's going to venture out into the social media world and say, listen, here is a premier course that you need to go through to learn how to handle these people when they come out. Yeah. And unfortunately, that, you know, they have to learn the hard way, I guess. And it's not good. It's not conducive for what we're trying to accomplish.
Well, and also neither is continued classification, and that is, yeah, literally our first clip is from Senator Grothman talking about the need to declassify these things and the fact of, right, many of them are well beyond the time that they should have been declassified and been available to an oversight panel, been available for congressional review, that kind of stuff, so that their constituents could be aware of it and of where their money went. All that. So let's go ahead and play that first clip from Senator Grothman.
They also highlight the urgent need for updated policies to address emerging threats, as well as more effective interagency cooperation and intelligence sharing. However, none of this is going to be possible without transparency. For far too long, critical information about UAPs has been either classified or ignored, leaving the American public and key congressmen without clarity needed to make informed decisions. Declassifying reports and fostering a more open dialogue about UAPs will not only increase the public trust, but also encourage collaboration between government, the scientific community, and our allies. Quite frankly, there's been things that have been kept secret that is, I think, old enough that there is no reason it shouldn't be released, regardless of any so-called, you know, private information. A transparent approach will allow us to share insights, identify patterns, and develop new strategic defenses. As we continue to investigate these phenomena, we must do so with a mindset of protecting our country, advancing scientific discovery, and upholding the trust of the American people, who right now I don't think have trust. And it's just obvious.
Yeah. And hearing a senator be that bold and that frank, like, I don't think anybody trusts any one of us right now, you know?
Yeah, he got that right.
You know, I mean, at least he's got the finger on the pulse,
you know, every policy, you know, because, yeah, I guess that maybe this is a big fear.
Go ahead.
If they have to admit that this was a conspiracy, and indeed what it is, then, you know, there's that trend out there. If there's one conspiracy, everything's a conspiracy. The earth is flat. We didn't go to the moon, et cetera, you know. And but, you know, there are some conspiracies, JFK and this one, you know.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to deal with it, you know.
Yeah.
They're going to have to deal with it.
Well,
and so it goes.
And, you know, it's one of those we say it on the show regularly, Earl. If conspiracies didn't exist, then there's a bunch of people that need to be let out of prison. We do have professional conspiracy theorists. They're called DAs. It's literally their job is to take a set of facts and weave a narrative and bring the jury down the trail of that narrative, given the facts and evidence at hand. Like, that is a conspiracy theorist.
In the IC community, we even started to change the word around a little bit. We took the word conspiracy and just rearranged the letters and came up with spicy acorn.
Yeah.
So whenever you see the term spicy acorn out there, a lot of people just, it totally goes by them. They don't even, it doesn't even register. And that's just one of the ways we address it. So, well, we got another spicy acorn here. And people are like, what? and they just, you just go on by it. But yeah, you know, a lot of things about how the conspiracies are pushed forward in the public eye is quite different than what happens behind the scenes. Inside that community, And when you have a top secret security clearance, and there's only three levels of classification, regardless of what anyone says, there's not like 36 levels and all these different things. There's a bunch of different SAPs that go under different monikers or different trigraphs, and that's understandable. But when they take on their own, like their own persona, and then they have this, you know, because it, everything is compartmentalized. And because of that, it also creates an internal conspiracy, because one person is working on one side of the project. One person is working on something that's in the same project, but something totally in another department. So that they two can't talk to each other. And this in and of itself feeds that mechanism that causes the conspiracies to leak out. So I can see where a lot of this comes from.
Yeah. And, you know, even the idea of, once again, new information coming out, that kind of stuff. One of the things that I was very, very excited to see was that, amongst the witnesses, and you know, that was something else that people said was like, you know, oh, it's all secondhand information. Like, I don't know. We had a rear admiral.
I know
that testified, and pretty sure that's firsthand witness. Like when he says that I got an email and it said this, and then that email disappeared from my inbox. Like that is firsthand
information on that.
Go ahead, Mike.
I might have some information on that. Go ahead. And if you want to, if you have a clip for him, go ahead and play that. And then I'll come back in with his sworn statement.
Yeah. Here we go.
And members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today regarding Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, or UAP. Confirmation that UAPs are real came to me in January of 2015 when I was serving as the commander of the Navy Meteorology and Oceanography Command. At the time, my personnel were participating in a pre-deployment naval exercise off the U.S. East Coast. It included the USS Theodore Roosevelt Carrier Strike Group, and this exercise was overseen by the United States Fleet Forces Command, led by a four-star admiral who at the time was also my superior officer. During this exercise, I received an email on Navy Secure Network from the operations officer of U.S. Fleet Forces Command. The email was addressed to all the subordinate commanders, and the subject line read in all capital letters, "Urgent Safety of Flight Issue." The text of the email was brief but alarming, with words to the effect, "If any of you know what these are, tell me ASAP. We are having multiple near mid-air collisions, and if we do not resolve this soon, we are going to have to shut down the exercise." Attached to the email is what is now known as the Go Fast video, captured on the forward-looking infrared sensor of one of the Navy F/A-18 aircraft participating in the exercise. The now declassified video showed an unidentified object exhibiting flight and structural characteristics unlike anything in our arsenal. The implication of the email was clear. The author was asking whether any of the recipients were aware of classified technology demonstrations that could explain these objects. Because the DoD policy is to rigorously deconflict such demonstrations with live exercises, I was confident this was not the case. The very next day, that email disappeared from my account and those of the other recipients without explanation. Moreover, the commander of Fleet Forces Command and the operations officer never discussed the subject. Even during.
So, yeah, there you have it. Pretty firsthand testimony once again of firsthand knowledge of these things. Go ahead, Mike.
Here's some back end information on that. The email is transmitted through CIPRNet, and CIPR is the network that the emails and information that classified is transmitted on in the military and obviously in the Navy. And when he used to be the chief meteorologist for the Navy, and that the Roosevelt group was off the coast of Jacksonville when this occurred.
Yeah.
And the GoFast video was recorded at that time. And the GoFast video, as most people know, has been thoroughly and is of the three videos is the most conclusively three videos. And it's clear that the information to resolve what that object is inside the video. So the problem that, you know, comes up in the mind of a skeptic, debunker, whatever you want to call us, is that when someone refers to that video in the light of that it's still currently
you know, not known as to either what it is, which is fine, but we don't, we may not know exactly what it is, but we know what it was doing. And what it wasn't doing was it wasn't fast at all, and it wasn't very high. I mean, it wasn't low and close to the surface of the ocean.
Yeah.
So that creates a conflict. The deconfliction of classified technology that was being utilized at the time was technology that was done by Mercury Systems. Mercury Systems creates a module called the DRFM, and Chris, you and I have talked about this before. And digital radio frequency modulation is a way that they use to emulate a actual radar signature, so that when the aircraft is in training and they're looking at their instrumentation, they will see exactly what they're going to see on the battlefield. So these, or the theater that they're going to be operating in. So these transmissions, what happens is this module receives a signal, can take the signal, copy it, modify it, and send it right back out before the radar that receives it even knows that something was done to the signal. So, and I spoke to, I don't know if I can say his name, but we'll just say that I spoke to someone that is in management at Mercury Systems, and was able to confirm, and this will be in the documentary that you know I'm making now about the three videos, that they were testing equipment supplied to them by Mercury Systems, and this is inside in any of the sources that you want to look for that shows that they were doing this, that Mercury Systems was testing their project. And if anyone remembers Project Nemesis, that was also a Navy program, Mercury Systems is part of that. So that explains the, when they see it on the SA, which is your situational awareness screen, where you can see a whole fleet of them, that helps explain what they're looking at. We'll get into a lot greater detail at some future date, because this is a lot to unpack. But this is where the problem comes in, is when they deconflict something, guess what they do? They go into anything that transmitted anything about it, and they remove that from the system. That's why he lost his email. And that's why the commanders were very ambiguous and vague when the subject was brought up. Same thing happened with Nimitz. If you remember, Nimitz was in training when their event occurred, and same thing happened with Roosevelt. Both times, their phased array radar systems were upgraded, Nimitz, and also same thing with, you know, Nimitz and Princeton, the same thing with the Roosevelt. And their Aegis freezer, their system was just upgraded, and now they can see objects they couldn't see before. So it's going to get real interesting really soon, and a lot of information is going to come out.
Well, and that was something that was brought up by Dr. Gold during the hearing, or Mr. Gold, rather, the former scientist from NASA and things like that. The idea that what we are using to study, like, you know, NASA and NOAA and things like that, have very, very specified instrumentation that's been built over decades of work, you know. And he was like, if we know so much about black holes because of the specialized equipment that we have built to study black holes, if we were trying to study black holes with what we're trying to study UAPs with, forward looking infrared cameras, things like, we would know nothing. We would know nothing. Right. None of these instruments are built to monitor that. None of these instruments are built to specifically look at that. So, like,
now, when their eyes on these objects, though, it wasn't just something captured on camera.
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
one saw go fast, and no one saw gimbal. No one saw, and the Nimitz event is totally separate, but the Roosevelt event, no one had eyes on either of those objects. Mm.
I know the Nimitz was observed. I mean, I've spoken with most of the pilots. I know Kevin Day, you know, who got the initial radar, you know, hits on the, you know, he's a strike force commander on the radar deck of the Princeton.
Yeah.
But there were eyes on, and they were, you know, being played cat and mouse with this thing. How do you explain something that's traveling Mach 18, not creating sonic booms, doing 180 degree turns on a dime, and waiting for them at their cap point 80 miles away? Now that stuff, you know, and I'll say, you know, I mean, I have people send me video all the time. I mean, yeah. You know, I had somebody that I respect send me a photo. This was just a couple days ago of what they thought was a disc. Of course, it was taken through the windshield of the car, and I'm looking at the photo, and I'm you know, and it's like, well, I really like this person, and I'm not going to bring up names. You would know who it is, but I swear it was like, well, you didn't see this with your eyes, right? No, I didn't. You saw this looking through your queue of photos afterwards. Yes, that's exactly. I was taking photos of the pretty sunset. I said, this really looks like a dragonfly wing, or maybe a bee's wing that flew onto the windshield. And you did, because that was the thing. There were no marks on the windshield, no splotches. Mm. I said, yeah, I get that. But this, if it was just like an insect wing, you know, it was there long enough for you to get the photo and then it blew off.
Yeah.
So, you know, photos and videos and stuff, I like them, but in my work, there's very few that I have usually, there's very few cases that I've made on photos and videos. Yeah. Multiple eyewitnesses. I mean, when I have like a flight crew that sees three silver chrome discs at the continental dateline that sit there, go into a triangular holding pattern, just sit there for a second so that everybody gets to see the show. And then they all shoot down together below the horizon, together at once, you know, like a flash. You know, these are people that we trust our lives in. This was a passenger airliner. It was the whole flight crew. I've spoken to the whole bunch of them. Nothing was caught on camera. There wasn't time, but everybody saw it. How do you, what do you do with testimony like that?
Well,
the problem with the eyewitness testimony is that I kind of view, because I do work with Discovery ID and I do a lot of video forensics and a lot of imagery forensics when it comes to either crime or when it comes to ufology or various other things. And one of the first things we look at is with eyewitness testimony, that's kind of that, you know, that's something we put in one category. And then we have the actual tangible, evidence that we have to work with if it's available. And generally, when you go to court, the absolute worst testimony you could ever produce in court is eyewitness testimony when you have actual tangible evidence to work with. That's what happened with Nimitz. It's the same thing that happened with Roosevelt. You've got Ryan Graves going around saying that they saw these objects every day for nearly 2.5 years. Well, if this was the case, then a lot more imagery and a lot more things were probably taken of these objects. And they should know after, I mean, if our military can't identify something after 2.5 years of seeing these objects every day, then that brings up other questions. It's a whole nother conversation to have. And if you go back to Nimitz, there's a lot of information that came out that wasn't exactly presented in the correct either chronological order or the way that people perceive it or remember it. And that's another area where eyewitness information is kind of taken askew and off to the side. And Kevin Day and I are, you know, we're friends, and I've talked to him. And, you know, on the last podcast, I had him, with him and I were both on. We went over this. One of the key questions I had for Kevin that totally changed everything about the Nimitz event for me, which is the key moment. Kevin's testimony is more important than anyone else's, in my opinion, was I asked him, I said, Kevin, when you talked about these objects that were moving, across your screen, you had five or 10, and it seemed to be in groups of five or groups of 10. I said, let me ask you a question. You said they were in a formation. My only question is, how far apart were these objects from each other? And most people, when you ask about a formation, they would say, not Merrill, I'll even ask you. I mean, how far apart do you think these objects were from each other? Mm. What, when you hear the word formation, what is your first thought that comes to mind as far as distance from each other?
About an aircraft width apart from each other?
20 feet, 15 feet, 20 feet closest, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And just so you know, every object that Kevin Day witnessed on his screen were over 10 miles apart.
Hmm.
No one knows that. Very few people actually know that information. You ask Kevin yourself, he'll tell you the same thing. And so that is a very key piece of information for me, because it totally changed every piece of information and data that I had at that point. I've got information that a lot of people don't have. And so when I condense all this together and put it in a package that people can see, and because we're visual people, it'll make the whole event make a lot more sense. Because right now it just kind of doesn't, and it's taken on a folklore status that, you know, that a lot of people are going to be angry with me when they find out what some of this possibly was. But I can't say 100%.
That even Mr. Gold testified to was that he has firm belief that a good 85-90% of what we are seeing is firmly known technology that either lies within the hands of a private contractor, or, you know, Lord forbid, a foreign government. Even Lou Elizondo said that during his testimony. Yep.
Earl said about his mom is very poignant, that the government is going to hang on to all that information. And I seriously doubt we will ever get a confirmation unless it's very blatant and someone comes out with the actual,
And that's just it. Now, granted, and I think that's what a lot of people within communities are very, very like, you know, you bought the whole seat, but you only need the edge about it. Where they think like, oh, you know, nothing happened. It's like, you know, no, they are not going to wheel out a cart with wreckage under a sheet.
Maybe somebody will, or
a large tube. Granted, not yet. However, there will come a day of accountability, and what they're doing is much like they did with Grush, where it's the idea of you're setting things up and you're showing the fact of these things do exist. And if we can show the fact that once again, though the crash retrieval program is unacknowledged, the injuries from it are fully acknowledged, so that in and of itself gives us reason enough to be able to go and follow money and go to contractors and figure out where that goes, because it is unfortunately a legal proceeding that we have to go through for big D disclosure. And whenever we had Steve Bassett on a couple times, we talked about that this is only going to come through legal means, you know, and it's not going to be some whiz bang show. It's going to be a slow rolling boil. And it's going to take a hot minute for all these pieces to come together, for all these Senate panels to happen, for accountability to come to play. And figure out which contractors it is, you know, because, you could say like, oh, it's in Hangar 128. And as soon as you announce that, get there 6 hours later. See what happens. See what's in 128. A bunch of skid marks.
Like, you know, well, I'm sure there's no longer a blue room because you know about the blue room. It's popular legend now. But all I know is that back in 1963, my mom sat down and told me pretty much what we're hearing talked about now. And, you know, she was working for an early contractor. It was Hughes Aircraft, working with Rand Corp, you know. My mom was taken to, you know, she worked in a facility. It was under the desert. This is, we're talking a long, long time ago. And yet, you know, talking with the DOD guys that I've spoke, you know, someone's a friend, you know, and it's like, well, no, I can't read anything else for you because your mother's file is sealed. We're talking about something that happened 80 years ago.
Yeah.
So if there's no there, then why all the fuss? Counterintelligence and you know, all this stuff around it?
And,
you know, that kind of points it out blatantly that there is a there.
Well,
why would my mom, in my mom's whole history,
you
know, she tried to be a housewife.
Yeah, I agree.
She failed. Yeah. She was happy as a clam once she got back into, she wound up being like a private headhunter for, you know, Lockheed, TRW, Northrop, you name it, right? And she did that till the day she died. She became very clammed up about what she did. Once in a while, I would get just like a very vague answer from her, you know, talking about, you know, well, what exactly were you doing on A Mile Under the Desert, Mom? Yeah. And, you know, she looked at me and was so pissed off and walks away. This was back like 1980, maybe. And then she stops as she comes back and she has a wicked grin on her face. And she said, well, you were there, son. And you know, it's like, what are you talking about? She said, oh, no, I was pregnant with you when I was working down there. So you were technically there as well. And then she laughed and she walked away. Well, where does this come from? You know, and my mom was horrified. I mean, I went and I talked about this thing in front of my fourth grade class, Thousand Oaks, California. You know, this was 1968, you know, about the same time that Bob Salus was, you know, having his incident with Malmstrom. And my mom, you know, I'll never forget, you know, she's driving us home. It's like, son, you didn't lie to your class. I didn't lie to you. But how did you remember this? You know, you were only a baby. And she said, you can't ever talk about this again. Your mother could get in horrible trouble. Your mother could go to prison.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now if this is all smoke and mirrors and BS and all made up, you know, to cover up, you know, government black projects, you know, Benowitz stuff, right?
Well,
why all the secrecy still in something and, 80 years ago?
And that's just it, Earl. And, you know, we're about to play a clip. I've got a couple lined up for back-to-back play almost. We'll come and hear this statement from Rear Admiral Dr. Gallaudet about specifically satellite imagery of UFO UAPs.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to that has been obtained and where that's in and what trigram agency has that, and then in addition to that, the disinformation campaign that we're talking about and the ongoing disinformation campaign, and then we'll hear from Lou Elizondo. We'll come back, respond to that, then we'll hear Lou Elizondo's version of the disinformation campaign. So here are those statements.
I'll help explain what trigraphs are.
Absolutely.
By an intelligence agency. That is a compartment of program that even senior officials, including myself, were not read into. Last year's UAP hearing before this oversight committee confirmed that UAP-related information is being withheld from senior officials and members of Congress. And just this week, I learned from former DOD official Chris Mellon that satellite imagery of UAP from a few years ago still has not been shared with Congress. Equally concerning, last year's UAP hearing also revealed that elements of the government are engaged in a disinformation campaign to include personal attacks designed to discredit UAP whistleblowers. Having never signed a non-disclosure agreement regarding UAPs, and now as a private citizen, I've become an advocate for greater UAP transparency from the government. The continued overclassification surrounding UAPs has not only hindered our ability to effectively address these phenomena, but has also eroded trust in our institutions. While I applaud previous bipartisan legislation passed by Congress concerning UAPs, a more comprehensive approach is needed to address the broader implication of UAP on public safety and national security, as well as the socioeconomic opportunities that open UAP research could unlock. Therefore, I recommend Congress take the following action.
There he is literally stating that, like, there is an ongoing campaign from elements within the government to discredit people in the UFO UAP community, to discredit whistleblowers, to discredit people like Lou Elizondo and Kevin Day and Fravor. You know, things like that. And to know that that is an active and ongoing campaign, is a little saddening and disheartening to hear, to say the least, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were going to explain the trigrams to us real quick, Mike.
Oh, yeah. I thought there were two.
I bring up this next clip.
Okay. Yeah. Basically, what a trigraph is, it's a three-letter designation that's given. Originally, it was done just for country codes like AFG is Afghanistan and, you know, so forth, CA in Canada and so forth. So the three-letter designation gives you somewhere around 17,000 different combinations of letters. You get 26 times 26 times 26, I think it's 17,576 or something. And so what they do is the human mind easily remembers three-letter combinations. So that's why all of your agencies, that's why all of your internal things, like I used to work for S32 and things like that, would always be given in three-letter designations, just for ease of use and for people to remember. But at the same time, there's some duplicates that you come across that gets rather comical. And one thing I'll say about the what you just mentioned about the satellite imagery, the National Reconnaissance Office back, I don't remember, I think it's 2012 that we actually did this. We had two imaging satellites. They were part of the K-8 series that were actually gifted to NASA. These are identical to the Hubble Space Telescope. In fact, the Hubble Space Telescope was built by Lockheed based on the K-8 series design. And so one piece of information a lot of people don't know is that NASA was given two additional Hubble telescopes for free. And some of those images that we're talking about would be coming from one of those types of satellites.
Yeah, and, if you've ever read up on optical technology, things like that, you've heard the fact that, like, you've been able to read a license plate from space since 1980.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, it's just, and that's true. And the resolution has changed only in the digital component.
Yeah.
Yeah, but your two centimeters is the maximum resolution you're ever going to achieve. Civilian satellites are set up for 30 centimeter resolution is your maximum that you're allowed to release. 15 centimeters is, what Maxar likes to work with. And then, of course, President Trump leaked his own image of the Iranian launch facility that revealed a 5-centimeter image.
Yeah.
And at that level of detail. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah. Whoopsie. With that being said, let's go ahead and move into Lou's statement about the multi-decade effort to obfuscate things. And this is a few minutes here, about 3 minutes, but he'll also get into why is there a psyops officer that answers these questions. So great question from Lou Elizondo. Here we go, folks.
Yep. Every agency has one.
Members of the committee, it is my honor and privilege to testify before you on the issue of unidentified anomalous phenomenon, formerly known as UFOs. On behalf of our brave men and women in uniform and across the intelligence community, as well as my fellow Americans who have awaited this day, thank you for your leadership on this important matter. Let me be clear. UAP are real. Advanced technologies not made by our government or any other government are monitoring sensitive military installations around the globe. Furthermore, the U.S. is in possession of UAP technologies, as are some of our adversaries. I believe we are in the midst of a multi-decade secretive arms race, one funded by misallocated taxpayer dollars and hidden from our elected representatives and oversight bodies. For many years, I was entrusted with protecting some of our nation's most sensitive programs. In my last position, I managed a special access program on behalf of the White House and the National Security Council. As such, I appreciate the need to protect certain sensitive intelligence and military information. I consider my oath to protect secrets as sacred, and I will always put the safety of the American people first. With that said, I also understand the consequences of excessive secrecy and stovepiping. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the aftermath of 9/11, which many of us remember all too well. I believe that America's greatness depends on three elements. A, a watchful Congress. B, a responsive executive branch. And C, an informed public. Over the last decade and a half, I learned that certain UAP programs were and are operating without any of these elements. Although much of my government work on the UAP subject still remains classified, excessive secrecy has led to grave misdeeds against loyal civil servants, military personnel, and the public, all to hide the fact that we are not alone in the cosmos. A small cadre within our own government involved in the UAP topic has created a culture of suppression and intimidation that I've personally been victim to, along with many of my former colleagues. This includes unwarranted criminal investigations, harassment, and efforts to destroy one's credibility. Most Americans would be shocked to learn that the Pentagon's very own public affairs office openly employs a professional psychological operations officer as the singular point of contact for any UAP-related inquiries from citizens and the media. This is unacceptable.
Absolutely. And once again, a long clip, but a lot to unpack inside of there. You know, the fact that once again, an obfuscated multi-decade effort of contractors obfuscating information from Congress, from congressional oversight, obfuscating money trails, all kinds of things. So.
And it can be deadly. 9/11, you brought that up.
Yeah.
It was compartmentalization gone wrong. And they were not sharing information between agencies. And we all saw, you know. And then you have the blowback from the public. Everything's a conspiracy now. You know, I mean, I could barely go on X anymore because it's just, you know, well, this is a conspiracy, so everything else must be.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a blemish and a problem and a blockade of truth. And it has consequences. And you know, I mean, I understand why they want to keep things secret. You know, I mean, I asked my mom point blank, 1977, I was older, I was a teenager, I was cocky at that point. You know, it's like, why the hell can't they share this, Mom? And she said, you know, public chaos and fear among the masses. You know, she brought up the Orson Welles radio broadcast. She said, imagine that worldwide. It could harm world religions, number two. That was the next one she mentioned. She said, we'd be sharing the information with our enemies. That's number three. You know, well, I think there was a fourth one in there as well. But you know, I understand all that. But you have this major distrust among the American public. Everybody's at each other's throats thinking that they're the gatekeepers of these secrets. And that there's, you know, you wind up with things like QAnon and, you know, where everything's a conspiracy, everything's evil, everything's the deep state. And it comes down to this is the major, I think, the flashpoint of all that.
Senator Muskowitz actually said that to the rear admiral at one point. It was like, many people would consider you a member of the quote deep state because of your many years serving our country and the positions you held at NOAA and places like that.
Jiminy Christmas,
you know, but even to see those terminologies and that kind of stuff make its way into this conversation was vastly interesting. And one of the most interesting things was the statement from Schellinger Schellenberger about Immaculate Constellation. The actual
that was new.
The actual retrieval program name, or at least one of them. The non-existent retrieval program, things like that. So let's check out that clip real quick from him.
For some time, quite possibly decades. Furthermore, these individuals have revealed the name of an active and highly secretive DOD unacknowledged special access program, or USAP. The source of that document told public, me, that the USAP is a strategic intelligence program that is part of the U.S. military family of longstanding, highly sensitive programs dealing with various aspects of the UAP problem. The new UAP whistleblower claims that the U.S. military and IC database includes videos and images taken using infrared, forward-looking infrared, full-motion video, and still photography. The report that was just shared with Congress says Immaculate Constellation serves as a central or parent USAP that consolidates observations of UAPs by both tasked and untasked collection platforms. Macula Constellation includes high-quality imagery intelligence and measurement and signature intelligence of UAPs, the whistleblower's report adds. The sources of this intelligence are a blend of directed and incidental collection capacities, capabilities, positioned in low Earth orbit, the upper atmosphere, as well as military and civilian aviation altitudes and marine time environments. The report to Congress details in detail various UAPs, including spheres, orbs, disks, saucers, ovals, triangles, boomerang, arrowhead, and irregular organic. The report describes various incidents found in the human intelligence databases. One involved orbs surrounding and forcing an F-22 out of its patrol area. In another incident, the crew of a Navy aircraft carrier watched a small orange-red sphere rapidly descend from a high altitude of 100 to 200 yards directly above the flight deck of the CVN, or aircraft carrier. And since my reporting on this Immaculate Constellation last month, another source came forward who told me that they saw a roughly 13-minute long, high-definition, full-color video of a white orb UAP coming out of the ocean approximately 20 miles off the coast of Kuwait. It was filmed from a helicopter. Then halfway through the video, the person said the orb is joined by another orb that briefly comes into the frame from the left before rapidly moving again out of the frame. The person discovered the video on SIPR, the Secure Internet Protocol Router Network, which the DoD uses to transmit classified information.
So there you have a pretty good accounting of much of the stuff that was in the report that he provided about Immaculate Constellation, the data gathering, all that kind of stuff, which is an amazing, amazing effort, and sounds like a literal treasure trove of data.
Well, it can. Hopefully, information will come out about that. Of course, if you tried to do a FOIA request for you know, Immaculate Constellation, you won't really get far. The names of these programs are changed often. We would change the name of the programs I worked in on general about every 18 months, sometimes less than that. And that was primarily to either work with different contractors, because you'd have to rename the program to something else if a new contractor was brought on board. So if you had Lockheed one day and then you were going to give part of the project out to someone else, then you would have a new name for that part of the contract, which would be under, it's a DD-254 is the Department of Defense number that they do the contracts under. And that information would be done in the bid process and so forth, which we know how the bids work with people like Bass and, you know, like Robert Bigelow and things like that that have brought a lot of that to the forefront. So I hope that Schoenberger will bring forward more information. The issue at hand is just like what we have with Lou, is that some of the information that has been broadcast through, say, SIPRNet is not something that you can just readily speak about without A, losing your security clearance, and B, possibly being tossed into Leavenworth. So these people are taking great risks to bring this information out. And at the same time, you have to question what's going on here with people like you have Lou Elizondo. And one question was asked a question that he said he couldn't answer in open session. The very next moment, he'd asked the same question and he answers it in open session. That in and of itself makes you wonder, that's kind of interesting that information should be classified and he has whistleblower protections. From what I understand, no, he's doing it on his own accord. So he's taking a great risk.
Yes.
But we'll see how this plays out. I mean, very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a conversation that I had with somebody the other day, the idea of whistleblower protections and what that is. And, you know, there's a lot that these guys are doing that, no, do not fall under whistleblower protection.
Yeah.
You
and,
know?
And just so you know, there is no whistleblower protection for top secret security.
Yeah.
There is zero, absolutely. And I'm telling you this straight up. I don't care what anyone says in the government. There is no whistleblower protection for anyone that reveals anything having to do with national security, period. Yeah. No matter what they say or what they claim the Congress is going to give them some sort of protection, that is total bunk. If you come out and you give something away that's of national security, you're going to have a problem.
If that was the case, that those PowerPoint slides that I have on my server from Edward Snowden, he wouldn't be living somewhere else. He'd be living right here.
Yep.
If that was the case.
That's correct.
You know, he gave away something of national security, which, you know, showed they were totally recording everybody's conversation about everything.
Absolutely.
There's a way that they can protect these whistleblowers.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, I guess, where the rubber meets the road here. You know, anything is possible, obviously. Things that are done can be undone, and they're going to have to come up with some. And I guess that the main question is there enough interest in Congress, enough interest to change some of these laws and actually give them those protections that they that they need?
Well, here's where they won't get it.
Oh, no, I can't imagine your communications being jammed at this critical moment.
Oh, no, it's the CIA. Now go back to where you were standing before, Mike.
We did lose you as you were talking, so feel free to reiterate that, Mike.
There he is.
Lost me, but the main
protections.
Oh,
typical CIA activity there, Chris.
I'll have to see what my stats in Virginia are for this episode.
Wow. How about now? You got me back?
There you go. There you go, bud.
There you go.
Okay, that's weird. I'm not sure what's going on. It may. Who knows? I know my phone is monitored. I'm sure it is with all the information that I have. And someone up in Bluffdale, Utah is trying to figure out how to categorize my stuff. Anyway, long story short, the what I'm saying right now is just so everyone that's listening has a full understanding as to the real reason why this whistleblower protection thing is BS. The whole thing is BS because the whistleblower protection is put in place so that we as a government do not do harm to our own citizens. Or we don't do something that would be categorically understood as being in an international rule of law that we're breaking, you know, like war crimes and things of that nature. That's what the whistleblower protection program is for. Revealing that we have an alien in no way, shape or form should get whistleblower protection. The reason is because it does nothing for our national security in reality. And this is going to, a lot of people are going to argue with that point. Right now. But here's the point being is that our national security doesn't depend on whether or not aliens exist.
Yeah.
It makes no difference if they exist or not. It's the difference is, are they causing a threat to us? The belief is that the possibility is that they are by going to our military facilities and doing the things that we keep claiming that they're doing. But the problem is we don't really have any true tangible evidence to support a lot of the claims that are being made. And that is the bigger issue. That's why, and I'm just telling you guys, I'm on your team. I believe that this is happening.
Absolutely.
But the problem is that no one is coming out from the military. And no one's going to come out and give someone whistleblower protection if that person reveals a national security secret. That's not going to happen. Never.
Absolutely. And once again, the existence of extraterrestrial life, not a matter of national security. Granted, you know, that is
scenarios,
you know, and that is a lot of what the good Rear Admiral referred to and referred back to, and a lot of what Lou Elizondo referred back to, is a lot of the reticence to come forward about this stuff. Even the other cases that he talked about, you know, the cancellation of maneuvers, things like that. The whole reticence to come forward with that is because it shows our inability to detect them, our inability to secure that part of the airspace that's ours, you know, so it reveals a vital weakness technically, you know, which is why you don't hear about these incursions, which is why you don't hear about these things. Now,
and those things are understandable. To a point. There are, we all three of us agree that we can handle whether or not the government has aliens or whether you know, we've been in contact with them for years, or whether they exist at all. All three of us, I'm sure, can sit and go, yeah, we're ready for it. We've been prepared for years. Movies sure. and whatever you want to say, you know, that has prepared us for it has done so. The issue is that the that dangling of the carrot, and, you know, I always think of that about the commercial where the guy's holding that dollar bill on the end of the line there, and he yanks it away at the last second. That seems to be what keeps happening to us for disclosure, is that we think we're getting close, a new report's going to come out, something's going to be earth-shattering or whatever, and then we all get excited and then for nothing.
And that
gets very... very frustrating.
I'm not excited. I'd like disclosure, but again, I tell all my people that work for me, you know, you are disclosure. Don't wait
That's
for
right.
the government.
That's
you know,
right.
you're investigating these cases.
Yep.
Do due diligence on these and do your best and show your evidence. And that's disclosure.
That's it.
You
that's
know,
it.
I mean, I grew up with the knowledge, and it didn't keep me from going to church and didn't keep me from getting out of trouble as a teenager,
right.
you know, it's pretty normal life. And, but you know, it is, as I said to my, again, I'm sorry, I keep returning my mom.
It's okay.
But, you know, here she is, you know, I mean, as I asked her, you know, why the hell not? That's a very important, you know, there are the trifecta of questions that matter to us. Is there a God? What happens when I die? And are we alone in the universe? Well, that's one of the three.
That's true.
That's
and,
it.
You know, I think that people deserve to know that if we have the answer to that, even if the information is scary, you know.
But I mean, the answer is not going to come from our government.
Everyone says our government is
keeping this away from us, and that becomes the conspiracy. Is that it's anytime the word someone says the word they are doing this, they're doing that. We all know the they is the government. And the thing is that in most of the situations, it's not really them.
You can't.
We got to focus on.
Go ahead. No, we have to focus on what.
I was just saying, I worked in government. Yeah. I had a security clearance. I was able to see certain things, but I didn't like go around looking for different things every day. And, you know, people used to joke with me. There's a file cabinet that sits at 9800, you know, Savage Road in Baltimore, or just outside of Baltimore at Fort Meade. That this black cabinet was the index of the information that was stored in an underground facility. So we would look, it's like index cards. And people would jokingly go by, looking for aliens, Sturber, looking for aliens again. You know, and I'm sitting there saying, come on, guys. And the information that we're all wanting to have come out is information that organizations like MUFON would probably have, that they will be the ones that bring it to the forefront. SETI, NASA, things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're doing it. You guys, everyone's doing a great job. I mean, And I have two incidences that happened in my life that are direct. One of which I actually filed with MUFON last year. And then the other one happened with my mother. And at this, you know, we witnessed something that was kind of bizarre. And we had some personal like contact, but not with the actual entity, but it made our vehicle, you know, radio turn off, our lights turned off, all kinds of weird things was happening. And so these are experiences that I had. That I can't, and no one is ever going to take that away from me. And no one that's listening to out there should take an experience that happened to you and have someone tell you that it didn't happen. That's not what this is all about. What it's all about is us trying to find the truth, getting to enough facts to support what we believe to be true, and to come at them with the actual, you know, here's the proof. We've got it. We don't need the government. We got it now. And that's what organizations like MUFON can bring to the table that no one else can.
I'm pretty aligned with that opinion, actually.
Good.
So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have to make up for the fact that I used to work for the government. People view me as the enemy.
And I know a lot of people, you know, that's their great hope is that this official disclosure. This is another thing I ask people. Who's going to disclose this to the public? We don't have a Walter Cronkite. And, you want President Biden to tell everybody? Half the country thinks that he's a doddering old, man that's got, you know, and if Trump does it, half the country is going to say, oh, it's fake news and he's at it again. And it's, I mean, who's going to tell them? You know, so that's the other question. I don't know who's going to deliver this news.
Yeah. Well, and
but, you know, hope rises anyway.
The thing is, number one, we can't say that they, once again, as Mike said, that they, the government, are withholding this from us, because once again, as has been evidenced in numerous statements in not only this congressional hearing, but other congressional hearings, is that this has been obfuscated from them and from their oversight. Oh, yeah. So yeah. They don't even know about it. So yeah. They can't very well be like willingly hiding information from you that they don't even know, you know? And that's what is important. That's it's kind of like, the example that I give regularly is the Acorn groups. Like I'm a big fan of Oak Island, but people get very upset because like, oh, they're never going to find the gold. And it's like, I think you skipped past the intro where it says one more person has to die. The episode where you don't hear that in the intro, you're probably going to see him pull up a whole bunch of gold. You know, until then, the science is the gold. The changing of history is the gold, you know, and we are getting zero. We aren't getting zero return on our investment on disclosure. Absolutely not. We are getting like beautiful fountains of gold dust coming through and confirmations of things that, yes, though many of us in the communities have talked about these things for years and we've heard about them and things like that. This is the confirmation to those who never thought it was actively possible. Okay. And that's what's important, is that those who don't believe it's possible, those like my dad who are like, oh, they're talking about little green men. Don't they ain't got something better to talk about? It's like, Dad, this is, what Grush is talking about is that basically you own a McDonald's and the dude that you have in charge of your shift every Saturday has been stealing money and misappropriating it every year since 1945. You know, is that important to you as the owner and the franchise owner of that McDonald's? It should be, you know, and it should be important to average Americans who aren't even involved in the cause of disclosure that, yes, these programs exist, that, yes, things and technology have been obfuscated from them on their dime. Their money has paid for it and they don't get to have the knowledge of it. And it's not even, as many of these folks are saying, not even a matter of national security what they're obfuscating. You know, so why obfuscate it? Why hide it behind doors, contractors? Why keep it back there? Why keep it from us if we've paid for it? You know, you do have to track down those money lines. You do have to tighten purse strings, and because that's all you can do is literally strangle them with the purse strings until they give up the information. You know, like that's literally the legal solution. I think people forget that's what Congress is there for, is the enforcement of laws.
You know, Ross Colehart, he put up a video today. It was John Stewart questioning the former, I can't remember her title, but it was about the billions of dollars that they can't account for that came out of my tax dollars. It came out of yours and yours and, you know.
Yep.
So somebody that's not interested in this at all, well, it's affecting you because we know that all this money has gone into it.
That's right.
You know, so
yeah,
it should be of interest to everybody.
Well, and that's just it. Now I want to go out with one last clip and one last discussion on it. But this is Senator Burchett asking about the crash retrieval program. So here we go.
Yes, sir, I do. I would never ever try to endorse providing some sort of information that could compromise what we call a blue force technology or capability. But I do believe there's a lot of information regarding this topic, and I've been very vocal about it, that should be shared not only with the public, but most importantly, with members of Congress.
Are you familiar with my friend David Grush?
Absolutely, sir. I had the privilege and honor of working with him myself several years ago at U.S. Space Force.
Last year, as you know, he testified that the U.S. has run a multi-decade UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering program. Would you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
Are there UAP programs operating without proper congressional oversight?
100%.
What are they?
Unfortunately, sir, I would have to have that conversation in a closed session.
I know you said that. A lot of people are frustrated with those kind of answers, but we're asking those kind of questions so you all know what the heck we're up against. You also mentioned in your opening statement that the Pentagon.
So, yeah. there you have it. You know, like I'd have to answer that in a closed session because I can't just publicly say that. But yeah, there is crash retrieval going on and alphabet agencies involved, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, these are things. I'm sorry, Mike. I had you muted accidentally, buddy. What were you saying?
No, go ahead.
No, please.
No, I was saying there's something that everyone needs to key in on, and it's something that's very important. It may not play itself out in the very near future, but it will play out. Keep in mind that he actually admitted that he knew David Grush from several years ago working in space work. Okay. So David, the question has been, is how did David Grush get put onto the scene? And the issue that a lot of people are having, and that I'll admit that doesn't look good on the outside, is that all of these people, there's a small group of people that keep pushing these same things that end up shooting themselves in the foot. And that is something we don't want to have. If we're going to go through this, we need the people that are pushing this forward to be truly credible, individuals that don't have some other agenda.
We need them to be impeccable.
Absolutely. And we're running into that issue. We ran into it with Lou. We ran into it, before Lou, but with Lou and Tom DeLonge and Chris Mellon and all of these different things that have happened over the last few years that are wonderful for the whole UFO topic to be moved forward. Has done an incredible job, but then at the same time, did TTSA, did they, you know, to the Stars Academy, did that create new issues that we have to resolve, that we have to work past and get around? Because everything goes back to like Hal Putoff and Kevin Davis, and just Eric Davis, as you move forward in time, you start seeing that these same players are inside the same groups. And as we wondered, is where did David Grush come from? And then when Lou says that one line right there, you know, people are going to jump on that and say, hey, obviously he was groomed and by these community. And now he's inside with the Hal Putoff crew and all of this other stuff. And that kind of takes away from what the overall accomplishments that all of these people have made. And we don't need any distractions. We don't need anything to take away from it. We need this to go forward. Because we're all on the same team. I push it from a different angle and other people push it from a more positive outlook angle. But I want to make certain that the ultimate scrutiny is put against these guys so that we know that what we're getting is actual facts.
Yeah.
And that's important to me.
Yeah. Cause even when pressed on USOs, you know, underwater submerged object or unidentified submerged objects, the rear admiral mentioned a case. This is where a lot of people have issue is that he mentions a case that somebody told him about. You know,
I did 2 years before Lou Elizondo came out and said that there was an underwater USO at 559.
Yep.
2 years prior to him doing that, I had that same information. I had the I can't say the report.
Yeah.
We'll just say it was like a DIRD, if you know what a DIRD report is. It was similar to a DIRD report, and that report mentioned this object underwater, 550 knots was the key thing. I contacted Simon Green, and Simon Green was in contact with me because we were about to do that documentary for Showtime.
Yeah.
And as we were going back and forth, I mentioned that in passing, and it wasn't given to me. I wasn't read into this particular program, so I wasn't under the same auspice that I would be under other programs I've been read into. So I didn't have that agreement. I didn't have an NDA or anything like that. So I mentioned that. And then everyone said,
you had mentioned it on Dudes and Beer back in the day.
I did. In fact, you were the first podcast I mentioned that on.
Yeah.
And I may have mentioned it on Breslow's as well. But then, you know, people said, you know, that's crazy. There's no object underwater. The, you know, transmedium craft and Salpeus patents came out. And next thing you know, here's Lou Elizondo 2 years after I brought it out, the same information. And then the guy who actually, I can't say if I was talking to him or not, but we'll just say that the person that was directly involved in that to get that information out of the public actually came forward from that submarine. And that was awesome.
And, but, you know, that's just it. I think that the pullaways, the takeaways for this, even for the community, even of experiencers, abductees, even for those pushing for disclosure, the Stephen Bassetts out there, people like that.
I agree.
The idea that so many of these things were pretty well confirmed. Once again, Lou saying that, like, I'd love to talk more about this, but I can't talk about the crash retrievals. Like, he can say, there's a program, but I can't talk about it. You know? And that's just it. That was driven home numerous times, you know, like in numerous times they asked him. So there's a crash retrieval program. Yes. Yeah. You know,
And I relate to that. I can relate to it. I have the same issue he has. He knows that I have it. Him and I have gone toe to toe on X before. You know about the big long protected argument, him using a sock account against me and stuff like this. But all of these different things aside, we are all really on the same team, even though we may have our differences and we may, you know, see things from a different perspective. I get it 100%. But the end goal is aliens exist. They are probably visiting us. They're probably not visiting us every day. So third phase of the moon has a new video to bring out. But there is that situation is happening. And at what level and at what point are the entities that have the information that would just put all this out on the table going to say, okay, I guess they're ready for it. Let's go ahead and give it to them.
Yeah.
You know? I think we're ready.
Well, and once again, as the good senator said, as everybody on the panel agreed, there is a lot out there that can and should be declassified at this point. You know, that is very much soft intel, soft human tell, you know, human intelligence, that kind of stuff. That is not vital to national security anymore. You know, that kind of stuff. And it's great to see, once again, these things be confirmed on the congressional floor. It is a slow and steady process, people. You aren't going to see, like, people dragged in handcuffs. You aren't going to see, like, you know, men in black or anything like that show up. But what you will see is a slow and steady process of exposure of this, of the topic, a normalization of the topic within the halls of Congress, which is what's necessary. It needs to be okay to talk about it. It has to be okay to talk about it to begin with. So until you have these things that show the naysayers that no, there's a reason we should be talking about it. Like, we have confirmed people now saying that there are programs USAPs, you know, unacknowledged special access programs that we do not have oversight of, that are using a lot of money, that have things that we should be oversighting and seeing, you know. That's a slow and steady legal process that you have to take to get there, though. You know, it's no flashbang.
Everybody wants it overnight. They everybody's complaining. It's not.
I would say I'm
up for every little bet because I didn't expect any of it. So
I would say over the long game, Earl, you know, this has been a fast few hands of poker over the last many years, over the last 3-4 years. It has been a rapid game where we are having hearings like this. Biannually, where we are having annual reports from newly formed places like Arrow, where we have conversations happening right now for civilian pilot. Where it's like, you know, let civilian pilots be able to report it with the same no fear.
Well, you know, the number the FAA has to report goes straight to Robert Bigelow. So I always thought that was comedy there.
It should go to me.
Right.
Darn it. You know, what's wrong with these guys?
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. But that was so funny when that came out. I said, wait a second. You call the FAA's number to report a unidentified flying object. Next thing you know, you're talking to Bass and the, you know, it's like,
Lord, this is legal.
Yeah. So, but that's just it. We have to normalize the topic and normalize the conversation and not in a sensationalistic ancient aliens kind of way, you know,
it's far stranger than that, I think.
I believe so as well, you know, because the truth is always stranger than fiction, Earl. And come the end of all of it, even when you look at things like it took us a long time to get to the bottom of, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin. And for that to be seen as what it was and dragging us into a war. It took us a long time to expose things like Iran-Contra and for us to understand that, the CIA was fully in cahoots.
The good guy at least pushing for this stuff. Same guy.
Yeah.
Christic Institute, you know, was well aware of him back in the 1980s,
And that's just it. You know, we have a well-versed history in the halls of Congress of calling these trigraph agencies to task and basically watching them lie to our face.
Yeah.
And then eventually bringing them back in and going, oh no, but see, look at all this, you know? And then you end up, sure, you end up with a fall guy like an Ollie North, but what you end up with is the fact of, oh no, The crazy was proven to be true, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where we're at right now. Like, will we end up with an Ollie North? Will we end up with a head of some unmentioned program from an unmentioned contractor being hauled before Congress and hand up, having to swear to this and having to swear to obfuscating billions of dollars since 1945 and things like that? We may well, and that would be awesome.
Interesting to see.
That is disclosure. You know?
Gotta watch this guy.
That is the face of disclosure. You know?
Canberra.
It's absolute truth, though. We may get the Houdini reveal of pulling the curtain back and there's the tubes with aliens in them. We might get that, but not until that guy who's in charge of the program is hauled before Congress and held accountable, you know, and has to turn over the keys to the executive bathroom and to the hangar that all that stuff's in, you know,
or we get some crazy deathbed confession or something.
Which happened, you know?
But
that's just it, guys. Thank you so much for coming on and really breaking down what this congressional hearing really is, what the importance of it really is and what it actively means to the communities on so many different fronts, because it's important for us to keep level heads about things. And it's important for us to acknowledge the small victories when small victories happen. And we have to be willing to look at moments like this and pick them apart and see those small victories that are there. You know, we could be negative all day long, but there were some huge things that were confirmed in this hearing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we let everybody go, Mike, let everybody know where they can go to follow 5x5 News, all that kind of good stuff, bud.
Okay. Well, you can follow us on YouTube. You can also see us on X. And also I'm putting a lot more effort now into the TikTok platform. It allows me to do quite a few things that my algorithm, days from back with the Las Vegas investigation, knocked us down for YouTube. So, I'm putting a lot more effort in TikTok. So TikTok, I'm under my actual name, which is Mike Turber, T-U-R-B-E-R. Engage with me there, conversate. We'll be doing some lives here very soon where you can actually get involved in the conversation and ask whatever questions you want. And I'll try to be as much of an open book as possible.
And thank you, Chris, for having me on.
You always are, my friend. Thank you so much for your time. As
nice
always.
Meeting you, Earl, by the way, too.
You too, Mike. It's a pleasure.
And before we let you go, Earl, let everybody know where they can go to follow you, where they can go to keep up with Southern California MUFON, as well as MUFON in general and making a report, that kind of stuff.
Go to MUFON.com. If you've seen a UFO, you go to MUFON.com. We've been in existence since 1969, doing the Air Force's job since 1969. They closed the doors to Project Blue Book. We opened our doors. So MUFON, MUFON.com, the Mutual UFO Network. For my local work, you can go to SoCalMUFON.com, SoCalMUFON.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm just Earl Gray. You can find me there. There's a couple of Earl Grays, but I'm pretty well delineated as a UFO guy. So, if you have a burning desire to get a hold of me, I'm on LinkedIn as Earl Gray Anderson, and I'll even dox myself, earlgrayanderson@gmail.com, if you want to get a hold of me.
There you go.
All right.
Please, good God, make note. Earl made the call to action, not me.
I may have to change my email.
That's where you got the gray from.
So good. I do that every now and then. So,
Earl, thank you so much for your time as always. It's fantastic talking with you. It's great having your friendship to be able to fall back on with conversations like this. Same with you, Mike. You are always a font of great stuff. So, appreciate you guys' time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. We're online checking out the great work of MUFON as well as Southern California MUFON at SoCalMUFON.com. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to follow all of the video pages of our guests like Mike Turber. They are embedded right there. Nice, easy to get to them. You can watch them right there on the website. Also, our second section is UFO and declassified government panels. That is where you can actively go and watch uninterrupted all of these UFO UAP panels direct from the government YouTube site, stuff like that. And just so you know, I also download all of them and have them on a hard drive in my safe. So should they ever disappear from the internet, they will reappear on the Curious Realm YouTube, should they ever be stricken from government record or taken off government YouTube. But all of those are embedded right there. It's great. So stop on by and check that out at CuriousRealm.com/videos, folks. Thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.